This is tape three, side B. You were talking about setting up the tanks.
Setting up the tanks and struggling a little bit with just growing the generations of zebrafish. And I remember when finally the fish that we raised, and these fish mated for the first time. And so we had the babies. And Florence gave me this big poster, "Lila, congratulations on your first grandchildren." And so, which was hanging on my door for a while. And I remember then one of my students, undergraduate students, coming to my office next fall and looking at this, then looking at me and saying, "You already have grandchildren." Say, so, yes, they are fish grandchildren.
They have gills.
So we had our first babies born here and surviving and having their own babies, and we started to just routinely then, because there were some improvements in food, a dry food for babies became available, which, you know, seems like such a very prosaic and unimportant thing, but actually facilitated our life significantly. Usually in fish labs, you need one research assistant to grow this live food for babies, so that's something that big lab can afford. But a small lab, I didn't want, you know, 80% of the time of my research assistant to be spent on food for babies, and right. This dry food, which we can just sprinkle, that saves a lot of time and effort and money. So that was all that was happening, and the animals were in place. One student and one research assistant, and then some undergraduate students started to join, be interested in the lab and doing some research. And at the same time, as the grants were being reviewed, I also were in communication with prospective postdocs. Both of them actually contacted me even before I started my own lab. I still don't know how they found me and how that happened, but one of them I know, because he came from Poland. Jacek Topczewski was recommended to me by colleagues of mine from the same university. Some of the colleagues I told you about yesterday, with whom we organized these scientific retreats, he came from the same department, so I knew exactly what type of education he got, and he came very well recommended by these people, so I was encouraged. He was working on yeast, so I knew he will have to make a big transition, but the same type of transition I made a few years ago, and at the time finding a postdoc with experience in zebrafish was practically unrealistic, so it was a very, very new discipline. I knew I will have to train people coming to my lab. Mm-hmm. So that was Jacek, who came here once. I heard about my grant sometimes in the summer. We knew they will have money for him to come here. And he came here in January of 1997. So 1 year after I came here, there was a first postdoc coming to the lab. And then just a couple months later, a postdoc from Spain, Encina Gonzalez, came with her own funding from Spain. So that was fantastic, because Jacek immediately started to clone Knypek. And at the time that was very difficult, because we had there was not enough information about the genome of the zebrafish to clone these genes. So it took us eventually about 3 years to clone, to identify what molecule is defective in this mutant Knypek. Mm-hmm. So Jacek immediately started to work on this project. Kim Fikeni, first graduate student, and then Encina Gonzalez, who the postdoc from Spain, started to work on the Bozozok project. So these two groups, as I told you, became immediately established in the lab. And we started to characterize both the mutant phenotypes, generate some double mutant phenotypes, and worked on cloning Knypek and also trilobite. What was happening at the same time, we started some collaborations. We started collaboration with Chris Reif lab at Cell Biology Department at the time, and that was very fruitful because they actually identified, and then we helped to characterize a gene affected in very famous mutant in zebrafish called Cyclops. That was not a new mutant for us. We isolated alleles of the same mutation in Boston, but it was one of the first mutations isolated in fish in Chuck Kimmel's lab in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But Chris Wright's postdoc, Karuna Sampath, identified that in Cyclops the gene mutated is a nodal gene called nodal, which turns out to be a key molecule in patterning from fish to mammals. And that was an important work because it linked for the first time the nodal genes to defects like cyclopia in humans. And after that work, publications have been appeared from human side that indeed this family is involved in some of the cyclopic defect in humans. So that was a very nice collaborative work with their lab, which I think was published in 1998. And then another big thing that happened for us was that as we were characterizing Bosazok, we did not on our own work towards cloning Bosazok. That was actually what Wolfgang Griever was doing. But the lab in Japan, Toshio Hirano's lab, identified a gene which, when overexpressed in the embryo, could induce formation of a secondary axis. So could induce, so we call it twinning. Instead mm-hmm. of one embryo, you have two embryos, suggesting that this is a very powerful molecule. On the other hand, the Bosazok mutants had almost an opposite effect, a phenotype. They were very defective in axis formation. They didn't have eyes, they didn't have forebrain, they didn't have a lot of midline tissues. So when I heard this talk at their talk at the fish meeting, after the talk, I asked them, well, this gene, which they call Dharma, and it's also Japanese for a god which has two faces, okay? Mm-hmm. And the Dharma could be Bosazok. And so we started a collaboration, and then indeed Dharma turned out to be Bosazok. So we knew that this is a transcription factor, meaning that this is a gene that regulates expression of other genes. And that was an important discovery on one hand, but at the same time it really facilitated our additional analysis of that mutant, because we knew molecularly what it was, and then publishing other papers about it, what it does during development, became much easier. So that project was developing very nicely, and we were publishing actually quite a lot on Bosazok. At the time, we were very quiet on the very quiet on the morphogenesis area, because on one hand, Jacek was cloning Knepek and Trilobite, which took us quite a while. Mm-hmm. And then I knew that before we publish anything, I mean, to publish anything in that area, we needed to invest a lot of time to answer the basic questions. How cells are moving in zebrafish embryo? What are the patterns of movements? Mm-hmm. So I've been... this is actually when Pew is coming in, because I was nominated for Pew in 1997. And actually one of the nicest letters I ever got was this letter from Pew, which is actually interesting, because I am used to letters providing good news about fellowships and about when you get a right letter from a foundation, it very rarely tells you that you actually got it.
Right.
Most of it tells you, we regret to inform you. So when I got this envelope, and that was 98, right? The spring of 1998.
Right.
And of course we were doing well. I had an NIH grant and I had March of Dimes grant still at the time. But we were developing very dynamically, so money is of course absolutely essential for that. And I opened that letter, and it stated that that I was the Pew scholar. That was really a fantastic moment, because mm-hmm. I knew that we will have this freedom actually to ask some questions that probably otherwise I would not be able to ask, and that we have just additional time to ask certain questions in a very thorough manner, that I don't maybe have to hurry and publish something before it's absolutely ready for that. Mm-hmm. So that actually allowed Pew from the very beginning was funding another postdoc in my lab, Diane Sepich, who became instrumental to all our cell movement analysis, which is a pretty difficult thing to do. You need a lot of patience, and you need to spend a lot of time with the microscope and later with a computer tracing the cells, tracing their behaviors. And Diane was really fantastic with doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what Pew has done for us at the time, that we could invest more into this what eventually became the bigger part of the lab, because initially the Bozozak project was bigger,
mm-hmm.
and we were developing the morphogenesis project, but eventually the morphogenesis project became much bigger. Just at the same time, I submitted in 98, I submitted for March of Dimes 3-year grant on Bozozak, which was funded, that allowed us to continue that project. And then I think in 1999, then I submitted a collaborative grant with Mark Cooper, who is in Seattle. And he is an expert in cell imaging and morphogenetic analysis. And we submitted a grant on how to say it best. It's also on Knipik and trilobite, but not on the early stages, but on later stages of development, when the embryo becomes segmented. So that was a very nice proposal that we put together, and that was also funded, which was very important, because later when I sent for the first time to renew my conversion extension grant, it was initially not, the renewal was not funded. So
mm-hmm.
actually having Pew at the time and having these additional grants was absolutely critical, that I did not have to contract my research group. We could continue,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually the grant was renewed.
Mm-hmm.
So I am being told, and as I observe people around, this moment around 5 years of, that's the most critical period where the grants have to be renewed, and you have to write a lot of papers at the same time, and sometimes tenure decisions are being taken. So
mm-hmm.
So that's a very, very critical period in life of any lab, and we managed to go through this period in a relatively smooth
mm-hmm.
fashion.
You received tenure, right?
That's right. It was actually an early tenure.
Right.
So once my department heard about the very good score on the second NIH grant, they are pretty adamant about having two federally funded grants.
Mm-hmm.
So Pew was icing on the cake, but the cake had to be there.
What does tenure mean at this institution at Vanderbilt?
It means stability. That's probably the most important thing. It means definitely means prestige. These are stability and freedom then of not maybe being so much confined by, you know, these time frames, that, you know, these things have to happen within 5 years, and that you have to publish certain number of papers, and sometimes maybe that sometimes pushes some people to publish maybe a story which is not completely ready. Maybe you would like to ask a few more questions about it and eventually publish a great complete story. But sometimes when tenure decisions are looming, you don't have this luxury, because you know that you, if you don't publish it right now, simply that
mm-hmm.
might be detrimental.
Right.
I did not have this problem. We've somehow naturally, the Bozozak project very, very quickly started to produce numbers of publications, and there were some additional publications still coming from the screen, which were not published together with this group of,
mm-hmm.
of papers. For example, a group of kidney mutations was published a couple of years later. So we did not have to, we had a luxury to publish when we felt we have a story the way we want to say it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. why don't you bring us up to date then? What is the current research that you're doing? Mm-hmm. What are some of the projects that you have?
So we continue on both fronts. We continue the organizer project, and we continue the morphogenesis project. Until last year, we've been mostly working with the mutations that I brought here from Boston, and we also received from other groups around the world. So we have not been doing any screening. Mm-hmm. Last year, in collaboration with Bruce Apple, we started to screen again, and that is going to continue probably for a decade or so. And these are new types of screens. As I was telling you, in Boston, we were screening basically by looking morphology of the embryos with a very simple dissecting scope without any additional markers. So there was a limit of what we could see. There were some structures in the embryo or some cell types. We couldn't, for example, see specific neurons or specific, you know, cells in the retina, specific mm-hmm. cell type. We could only see the dye was smaller, for example. We could detect that. So now there's a new wave of discoveries and genetic screens, which is based on the fact that we can generate so-called transgenic embryos in which certain cell types or structures are highlighted by fluorescent mm-hmm. Tags. So now using a fluorescent scope, for example, Bruce has this beautiful transgene which highlights oligodendrocytes eventually forming glial cell that sort of surround the neurons in the central nervous system. So they are screening for that. We actually decided to screen, and that was funded in my renewal of my grant, a screen for modifiers of KNIPEC. And the idea of this is that we have KNIPEC mutation in the background, and now we are asking for mutations which would modify the phenotype, right, particularly that would enhance the phenotype. So that's a screen already ongoing in the lab. However, we are just raising another transgene which highlights expression of one of the genes that we worked in the lab, conserved from fish to mammals again, which has really spectacular expression pattern. It highlights some structures in the developing gastrula at the time when the cells are moving, and we think that that will allow us to see very subtle defects in movements of certain cells in the developing central nervous system and in the developing midline. But then it has some expression in the fins, some expression in the eye, some expression in cloaca. Really highlights a number of structures that we otherwise maybe would not be able to see as clearly. So that's another basis of the genetic screen to be continued next year. I probably want to say that we are significantly expanding the whole operation at the moment, and that was possible because 2 years ago, we applied internally for something that the new chancellor called Academic Venture Fund. He funded a number of grants for the research ongoing at Vanderbilt, and he wanted to invest in areas that can make a difference at Vanderbilt. And at the time, there was, besides me, there was Bruce Apple and also Tao Zong, hired by medical school. Mm-hmm. And there started to be significant amount of interest in zebrafish, not only by primary fish investigators like myself, but also by physicians, scientists, and people all over medical school who want to use zebrafish in parallel to what they are doing in the human or they are doing in the mouse.
Right.
So along with Heidi Hamm, who is a chair of pharmacology and one of my collaborators, and Al George, who is head of the Division of Genetic Medicine, we put together this grant for Academic Capital Venture Fund, and that was funded. And that provides almost $10 million of dollars over the next five years, now next 3 years, to specifically invest in the infrastructure for zebrafish at Vanderbilt and to hire several more faculty. So we are expecting for Ella Knapik to join us later this year, and we are currently recruiting another zebrafish person to our department this year. So I was able to hire a number of postdocs who would develop new technologies. So one of the postdocs is involved in the screening that I was told you about. Mm-hmm. But there is another very important technique that we are also developing, and let me explain that to you. The screening that we are doing is the method is called forward genetics, meaning you mutagenize fish and you look for defects. You don't know what the gene is, and you have to clone the gene. So this is forward genetics, looking for phenotype.
Mm-hmm.
There is another logic called reverse genetics, that you have a gene, and now we know the sequence of the human genome, we know the sequence of the mouse genome, we are almost there with the fish genome. So we know all the genes that are in our body. We know only for a fraction of them what they are doing. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you have a gene, you have a molecule, you want to know what's the function in the organism. So you would like to disrupt function of the gene. And there are technologies for that in the mouse. Technologies like that do not exist for fish at the moment, and people are working on it, but methods have been developed that would allow us to find mutations induced by ENU, which is this method that I developed in the past, to find mutations by ENU in a specific genes. And that basically uses a lot of busy work and molecular biology in a nutshell. So Fish Initiative is funding one of the postdocs in my lab to develop the technique at Vanderbilt, and we are very excited about that, because for us and for our collaborators, having a mutation in a gene we are studying is a very valuable asset. And then other technologies that are being developed, there's another postdoc which is also developing these technologies, which allow to survey which genes are expressed at different stages of development, or allow quickly to compare the repertoire of genes being expressed in the wild type versus mutant situation. So the lab, on one hand, continues along these two broad schemes of patterning and morphogenesis, but our possibility to use very exciting new technologies is really good. So this is a very exciting, but also a very busy time for us.
Mm-hmm. You created sort of a mecca of zebrafish research right here.
Well, the mecca will be only one, and that will be in Oregon. But we hope that we are creating a center of excellence in a way, a group of good labs with a lot of fish expertise. The labs will be cooperating, providing different types of expertise, and we hope that whoever comes here will be able to use all the state of the art technologies. Not limited by by that, but hopefully.
And where do you see the lab going in 5 to 10 years? It seems to me. And part of it, of course, this huge grant that you just spoke about, that's going to play itself out.
That's right, and that of course. So at the moment, I'm definitely committed to some of the collaborations I initiated. Some of these collaborations go beyond my immediate interests, and I hope that with some people that we'll hire, these people will provide the expertise, which might be even more appropriate than my expertise, to support some of these collaborations. For the next 5 years, I want to continue to build on the and expand, maybe not horizontally, but rather more deeply into the mechanisms of morphogenesis and patterning, early morphogenesis. One area that I'm thinking about also addressing is morphogenesis of the neural tissue, so later stages of development, morphogenesis of the brain, and particularly forebrain.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that we will be thinking about, and as we do genetic screen, I think that's definitely a subject that I want to target, to specifically look for mutants which would be affecting morphogenesis of the anterior central nervous system. So that we'll be paying a lot of attention to that, because a group of mutations can open, as much as it opened gastrulation for us and patterning, it can open this next question. But
right.
I am not seeing my group expanding, 20 or 30 people in the future, because already I feel very much committed to people in the lab, and there's always a price that you pay if you expand your lab too much, that the attention of a PI becomes very, very diluted. And, I think the success of every person in the lab is very important to me, and therefore we will put a limit in terms of expansion to make sure that, that I have enough time to spend with people and make sure that, that they are succeeding in right. whatever they want to do.
All right. Assess your efforts so far in achieving your goals. Are you more or less where you want to be or further along?
Sometimes I think I'm farther along than I wanted to be, but in terms of what I'm doing, I'm exactly where I wanted to be. And, as we were discussing yesterday, I never set goals in terms of, you know, where I want to be in terms of position or something like that. These things are really, I treat them almost like a driving license. You know, I need position and tenure just to be able to continue to do science. That's the most important thing for me. And being able to do what I'm doing, that's again the most important thing for me. And at the moment, I see absolutely no inclination of becoming a chair of this or that. But again, you know, I've been surprised in my own life by wanting something that I didn't want before. So who knows? Maybe that will change. But at the moment, I'm just very happy to be able to continue to just do research and teach.
Right. What is the source of your funding now for your lab?
So at the moment, we are funded by two grants from NIH there is also the funding from this academic venture fund supporting some of the postdocs. And then we have a number of grants pending and some new grants that are being written right now.
Mm-hmm. And how much does the source of your funding shape what you undertake, pursue the projects?
Well, without funding, you cannot do biological research. So you always have, and especially if you're lucky enough to have funding like Pew or other sources that allow you this freedom, this is when you can do new things and expand your portfolio and expand your research base. And once you obtain some preliminary data in these areas, then you can write new grants to foundations like NIH or NSF.
Mm-hmm. A question about applications of your research. What are the potential clinical applications? I realize that, you know, some of this is speculation, but where do you see how this stuff could be used and applied?
There are two major outcomes of that work. One is connecting specific birth defects to specific genes, mm-hmm. and that can be important in diagnosis of birth defects and also possibly treatment in very, very in the future. There is huge number of birth defects, either children born with these defects or children basically not born because of different defects. And the numbers are actually extremely soft, and they vary. I hear and read in some sources that about 25% of human pregnancies fail, up to 50% of pregnancies fail due to either environmental or genetic defects. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, even if this is just 25%, which would be the lower estimate, I think we don't even touch the tip of an iceberg in terms of understanding which genes can give defect like that when mutated.
Right.
And I think this is where our research is very relevant. I already mentioned to you that our studies, collaborative work on cyclops, which affects nodal signaling, that linked for the first time the nodal signaling to cyclopia in humans.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, actually, I have a very interesting collaboration with Guillermo Oliver at St. Jude, and we published one paper together last year on a gene called SIX3, which is a transcription factor. In humans, mutations in the gene are connected to the defect called holoprosencephaly, which is very similar to cyclopia. It's a fusion of eyes and forebrain.
Mm-hmm.
And we are doing some very interesting inter-model system work, where we at the same time are studying, are asking what is the activity of exactly the these proteins in human individuals, the mutated proteins that can lead to holoprosencephaly. We are studying activity of these proteins in zebrafish embryo and in the mouse embryo at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what the model systems are on. You can do experiments you cannot do in humans, right? Because once you are presented with a child with holoprosencephaly, you simply don't know what happened at the time of development. So you want to create a model system like zebrafish or mouse to be able to watch. And in fish, this is particularly easy because of the traits of the fish we already discussed. Mm-hmm. So birth defects is one. One of the biggest discovery of the last decade or so is the realization that the genes that cause cancer are exactly the same genes which are either involved in development or regulation of the cell cycle. So some of the genes we are studying, actually the morphogenetic pathway I told you about, KNIPEC and trilobite, and downstream components of that pathway are oncogenes and can be related to tumor formation or metastasis. Mm-hmm. And I was telling you where I was today morning. I was at the meeting of the local American Cancer Society, where people funded our meeting. And I don't have, my lab doesn't have a grant from ACS, but actually one of my postdocs, Jason Jessen, was his work on trilobite was actually funded by ACS. Mm-hmm. And that's a very nice recognition of the fact that these studies we are doing are important for understanding tumor formation and metastasis.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's change gears a little bit. We'll go and talk about duties you have as a PI.
Mm-hmm.
How big is your lab right now?
So we have to talk in layers. We have two research assistants and three graduate students. Several already graduated. And we have five postdoctoral fellows who work directly with me. And then I have what I call adopted students and postdoctoral fellows, who are our collaborators. And some of these actually live in our lab. Some of them are just coming to fish facility in our lab to do these experiments. And that would be another six or seven people working closely with us. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing maybe about 17, 18 people.
Yes,
there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and do you still do bench work?
I can tell you what I'm doing. I continue to work with fish. There is a constant need to just maintain mutant lines, and everybody in the lab is responsible for a few mutants, and I'm maintaining some mutants that nobody wants to deal with at any given moment. So I continue to do this. I was very much involved last year when we were doing mutagenesis because I was training people how to do it. I participate in the screen, so I actually go and look at the embryos myself. And also that's what I'm doing almost every day, is to look at embryos. People inject in the morning either RNAs or different things, or treat embryos with different chemicals, and I spend a significant amount of time, which usually looks that I either go to the screening room, as we call it, and just look at embryos myself, what's on the shelves, or people just grab me when they want to show me something. So mm-hmm. that's something that I continue to do.
Mm-hmm. You have administrative duties as well, mm-hmm. things like admission committees, doctoral committees, I assume.
Last year was really, last year got totally out of control. I was on so many, I always amaze myself with, the more things I can handle at the time. But, for example, January and February of this year got to me severely, I have to say, because I was teaching genetics, which is a very demanding course for me. It was almost 91 students when we started to teach. And I, when I started to teach, I always, several years ago, as point of an ambition, I try to learn the student's name, and I continue to do that, try to do that.
Right.
That's challenging with 91. I think I succeeded in learning maybe 75 of them. So teach that 3 times per week, and then there was a number of, a lot of my responsibilities are reviewing papers and grants, and in recent years it became very, very heavy. At the moment I'm on editorial board of a number of journals, so I feel obliged to review to these journals, even at the time when I already have like 2 assignments, and when these journals contact me, I feel I cannot refuse. I have to take that assignment on. But internally at Vanderbilt, I am on the Institutional Animal Care Committee. I'm only a temporary member, so I'm called only when they need me to walk around and review the situation in different animal facilities, for example. I am on graduate recruitment and graduate committee. We had a number of meetings in terms of recruiting this year. I was also on so-called ad hoc review committee, which Dean put together to review fourth year review throughout the college, which also took significant amount of time and review. And I'm probably missing a few,
right,
which I'm trying to block in my memory very quickly.
Right. I wanted to ask also, you've already mentioned teaching genetics.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you teach? Do you have other teaching responsibilities other than, of course, the people in your lab?
I also teach developmental biology in the fall. So I teach half of developmental biology course, which is a smaller course. This year it was about 20 students, 7 of them graduate students. And I teach vertebrate development, which for me it's I mean, on one hand it's very easy because that's what I do. On the other hand, developmental biology is changing with such a speed that every year, and this year particularly because I was on sabbatical last year, I completely just changed what I was teaching, because it would be insane to try to ask students to remember all the genes that we know, because we already know too many for them. So it's always a matter how you teach them, that you give them an excitement of this discipline, and what are at any given moment the most important what's the most important knowledge that you would like to relay to them. So even that's, on one hand that's easy, on the other hand I put significant amount of time in preparing these lectures for them.
Mm-hmm. Right. How much job-related travel do you do? How much do you travel a year?
When I'm teaching, I try to avoid travel for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But altogether, I try to limit my traveling not more than 1 to 2 trips per month. So that's actually a significant amount. As I mentioned to you, last year I was on sabbatical for the entire year, and I used this as a time to travel a little bit. And I was invited for a number of meetings and visited some very interesting places, like Singapore, for example. And I spent I called it micro sabbatical in London. I spent 10 days, visited all the zebrafish labs in Cambridge and in Mill Hill. So that was a very nice trip. So yes, a significant amount of traveling, but there was 1 year when I overdone that, and when you put together teaching responsibilities and then traveling, then again I felt that took too much of my attention, so now I have a rule: no more than 2 trips per month are allowed.
You're right, and I do a little bit of that myself. My heart goes.
So you know what that means.
I wanted to ask too about one of the duties you have is obviously managing your lab too, just managing people. How much time does that take? And then also, I know commonly for many Pew scholars, that's not something that they teach you usually when you're going up through the ranks. I mean, what? I guess, how much time does it take to do this? And then also, what could help, let's say, people who are starting their labs manage people better, do you think?
Right. Our education does not really prepare us for this, and that's one of the many things that you are never taught, but then you have to learn in a hurry. The way I've been doing that is that initially I was meeting with my lab members on an individual basis every week. Now that would take almost my entire time. So what we are doing is that there are weeks that I meet people individually, and for example, this week is the week that I have meetings, and my time is blocked significantly. And then every other week we don't have individual meetings, but we have meetings in the thematic groups, which sometimes are as broad as the patterning and morphogenesis, but sometimes I redefine the groups, and we talk just about the topics that we want to, that I want to talk in a given week, and in different arrangements of people. And my approach is very intuitive. Every person is different. I told you that I don't like the negative incentives, and that's the last resort that I try to use. I try work on very much on creating an atmosphere which sometimes just happens naturally. And I've been extremely lucky with the first group of people that joined the lab. Florence and Kim and Jacek and Athena, which all of them were extremely enthusiastic. And then the new people joining the lab simply just go into that pattern. I mean, and that's your best mentoring tool, is your own lab. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people coming to this lab and just being naturally... naturally molded into that pattern. But then every person is individual, and I try to get to know every person at the beginning, as when they join the lab, is you know, how, what is their style, what's their character, how can I help them to achieve best they can in this situation in this work. Mm-hmm.
Right. Another duty you have is putting out journal articles. What is the process in your lab for getting journal articles out?
As we do research, at some point we think, well, we really have an interesting story that is developing here, and it's time to start thinking about preparing a publication. And we start with first putting together the data. So we have all the data, or at least part of the data, in the form of the pictures, because that's, for us, that's one of the main data, and the numerical data and a type of quantitations about cell behaviors, gene expression patterns that we can have. And next step is putting an outline of the results, where the student or postdoc would prepare an outline, and we look at it and we discuss, is it a proper logic of putting out the story? The next step then is writing the results, and they write a first draft, and we start to go back and forth to shape these results. At some point, it's pretty obvious what type of introduction do we need. And then depending where the paper is going, is it going to a journal like Development, where we have a luxury of pretty long introduction and then long discussion, then the introduction will be prepared accordingly. If we think we have something very, very exciting, and we would try to send it to a major journal, mm-hmm. Then it has to be very much compressed, and the introduction will be minimal, and then the discussion is part of the results, so you more or less write the results and the discussion at the same time. And from the very beginning, we know what we have. Sometimes, of course, we aim for a high-profile journal, mm-hmm. and we have to fight for it and shop around, and sometimes eventually, from a short introduction, we have to write a longer introduction and send it to a journal which accepts this format. So we start with writing the results, and as the results unfold and we are perfecting them, then we write introduction, and either the results are expanded by a discussion narrative, or we write a separate discussion. And somewhere there in the middle, materials and methods are written, because that's the easiest part,
right.
to that. And eventually we then have a draft, which we circulate first among the people who are very close to the subject in our group. Then we would ask a member of the group who are not directly related, or even, you know, the patterning group would read the morphogenetic papers and vice versa. And then we ask our colleagues at Vanderbilt, very often Bruce Apple for me is a natural colleague to read my papers. Sometimes when the most important papers that we have published, we would then often send to, I would often send to some colleagues, my good colleagues in the zebrafish community, to look at them and to give me some critical feedback.
Right. Okay. We're getting low here, so I think I'll...